free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, see our past archives, and see what's coming down. Today is October 29th, 2007, and our guest is Clint Seward. He is the inventor or discoverer of what he calls, what is called the Colliding Plasma Toroid Fusion. His company is Electron Power Systems. They're developing a process that remains stable without magnetic confinement by using background gas pressure for confinement instead. It could provide clean, non-polluting energy technology at one-tenth the cost of present energy generation. Clint, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Sterling. I'd like to say thanks a lot for the work you guys have done to understand and take an independent look at our technology. It's been very helpful.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. You have been on our top 100 energy technologies list just about from the beginning when we started that list a couple of years ago. And I believe you're right near the top, in the top 20 or so right now. Let's talk about before we talk about all the business end of things, let's talk about how this thing works and kind of the general idea of what you have here.
Well, it's quite simple in concept, and it works about like this. There's something in wide use in the United States called fusion tubes. People don't talk about that. They call them neutron tubes. And what they do is they collide hydrogen ions to produce energy and it's fusion. It's nothing else. It's been around for about 50 years, but the fusion word scares people. They don't use that, but those tubes are small, about a meter in length, you know, 3 feet, and they produce neutrons. And the limiting factor on them is the density of the hydrogen, and we've been able to figure out a way to overcome that. And here's how we do it. We have a new discovery of a plasma toroid, like a little donut, and we've learned how to make these that are dense, and they you have to make them in atmosphere. They need background pressure, and if you do, in theory, you can make them large enough that you can substitute them into this plasma tube and get very high density hydrogen, and so you'll produce a lot of energy, and that's what we're working toward doing right now. And we, you know, it'll take a bit of time yet, another couple of years probably, but we seem to be making progress every day toward that goal. And one of the important things is that you guys have looked at that has been very helpful. You've independently looked at the physics and the papers that have been written by some of the top scientists, and have seen that they make a cogent argument that supports our data and our theory.
Now, on this technology, one of the questions that we ask any technology is the status of working prototypes. Yours is a bit more of a theoretical concept, but you have done some prototyping, if I remember right. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's still a bit researchy, but it's not just physics. We actually make a plasma toroid that is stable in atmosphere with no external magnetic fields. We've been doing this for a few years now. The difficulty we have with it is it's quite small at this time, about 5 millimeters across, and we've had to do a lot of work, a lot of inventing, if you will, because no one is working in this area but us, and so we've had to invent how to make them larger. We think we've overcome that engineering-wise, but we're not ready to show or announce anything yet. And we're still researching until we can do it and do it repeatedly. That's where we are. So we make small plasma toroids that are stable in atmosphere with no external magnetic fields. All of your plasma physicists out there that are listening are going to go, that's not possible. And yet we do it, and we've had that independently confirmed. Making them larger, that's the trick. That's what we have to do, get them a little bit larger, and then capture them in a way that we can collide them. And we're pretty sure we know how to do it. It's an engineering problem at this point.
Now, the purpose for making them larger, is that for scaling electricity generation, or why is that?
Well, that's a good question. We have to make them larger, we think, so that we can capture them. They're like little donuts. We want to capture them around a wire, a central wire, and when we can do that, or a central wire, when we can capture them, then we can collide them with 100% certainty. Right now, we make them. We can't quite capture them, and it's hard to direct them into where we need. And we haven't been able to figure that out real well. If we can make them 100%, so that they collide 100%, then the process will be quite simple. And to do that, they have to be bigger than the half millimeter. They've got to be. We know the size, and we'll make them about 2 or 3 centimeters across.
Okay. And when it's 2 and 3 centimeters across, what kind of energy generation are we talking about?
Well, that's a good question. Each one will produce about 50 kilojoules, which isn't a lot, but we can make a lot of these, one right after the other. So we make them rapidly and bring them together rapidly and together, it's a small process. It's a, like an incremental process. So you make one, you collide those, make energy, then you make a second, you collide them and make energy, make a third. And we've seen these, we produce them at about one per millisecond. And we know we can make them faster than that. So you get some idea that we make a lot of these to make them fast. And what's nice about that is that it makes that process inherently stable, meaning, it's not like some nuclear process or something that can get carried away and go critical. These are very small incremental processes. You do one at a time, so it's easy to start them, and it's easy to not make any more, and you can control it quite well.
Are there any radioactive components to the system?
Well, the answer to that is there will not be in the long run, and why we say that is because we can make these out of hydrogen or out of any gas, and or out of any ion. And so, in theory at least, we can make them out of the boron-11 or out of proton. Those are each ions, and collide those two. And we could then make it such that it will produce hydrogen only, helium only, with no radioactive components. That's not been done, but it has been done by others, that process, but not by us. So in the long run, for commercial work, it would be non-radioactive. In the short run, it would be easier probably to do this as a scale-up to a regular neutron tube, which produces neutrons and is therefore a radioactive kind of a process. But it's all within, a very low level and the kind of thing that's controlled by Department of Energy.
On your website, you talk about using these for vehicular transportation, for home power, city utility power, and even for spacecraft going from one planet to another. So obviously, fuel is not a fuel supply line is not an issue, but you do have a fuel source that is consumed at a slow rate, and that would be boron or hydrogen in this case.
They're both. If you collide a boron 11 with a proton, you produce two doubly ionized helium ions, and so you're converting the boron and hydrogen into helium. So you do use that, but there's a lot of boron around. It's one of the most plentiful of elements, and several people that sources that we've looked at have said there's hundreds, maybe even thousands of years supply of boron. But and so there's a lot of it around, I guess, is the answer to your question.
When you say 1,000-year supply, at what rate of consumption?
Well, there's a good question. I mean, we've looked at work by Professor George Miley at the University of Illinois, and he wrote a book in the 70s of that first did a good look at fusion, and they're trying to figure out just how much fuel there was to answer exactly the kind of question you had. And he projected the amount of energy that the human species is consuming per year and what the growth rate was and things of that sort. And that's where he estimated the 600 to 1,000-year estimate from known reserves of boron as to how long it could fuel a society similar to where we are right now. You have to assume in that 1,000 years that we'll figure out some alternatives, but it would certainly end the dependence on fossil fuels that we have right now.
And that would be if the entire infrastructure was switched from fossil over to the boron?
Well, that's true. But you have to remember that one of the advantages here is that if you really can build this small fusion tube that we're talking about, small energy tube, the fuel, if we use hydrogen and boron, the fuel mass is approximately 100,000 times less than fossil fuels. Fossil fuel is a chemical reaction. You need a lot of fossil fuels, a lot of mass, just a lot of volume of coal and oil in order to move a car around. But here with boron and proton, you're almost talking about something the size of a thimbleful for your car for a year. I mean, it's a very small mass of fuel. So when you say changing the infrastructure to boron and hydrogen, that's exactly what you would do, but it would mean eliminating all your oil tanks and all your gas tanks and things. And you'd go to a store once a year and buy another year supply of boron, which is very safe. You know, it's like Baraxo almost. It's a very safe element, and you'd put that in your car. Get a little, like a little CO2 cartridge, if you remember those things, a little CO2 cartridge kind of thing, almost like a D-cell battery. You have one for hydrogen and one for boron.
The mechanism of getting the boron fuel into the chamber where it does the reaction, it's not like fuel where it would just run through a hose or a metal pipe. How are you getting the fuel from the tank, so to speak, into the reaction chamber?
Well, the way we do it now is we would make an electrode of the boron. And then as the we actually ionize it by using an arc, and the arc heats the boron, and we don't use boron. Right now we use carbon. It heats the carbon and ionizes it, and that's what we see. So if we use boron, it would do the same process. That's, I have to tell you, we haven't done that yet, but that's the way that we would envision doing it.
So basically, you'd be replacing the boron electrode?
Right. It'd be a, you would change an electrode out every once in a while, about once a year kind of thing.
In the case of something where you're consuming large amounts of energy, a spaceship, for example, would it just be a matter of a larger electrode? So the rate of maintenance or of changing out would be more frequent, but still not that often?
I would envision it that way, exactly. If you, I don't know if you're aware of a much, not too many people are, of how an arc furnace works, but an arc furnace works with a single electrode that gets consumed by the arc furnace, and what you do is you just keep feeding the electrode. As the electrode is eroded or used on the front end, you add more electrode on the rear end and more or less push it into the process. And so it would be a continuous feed, and you would just keep feeding it as to keep it from ending the process. But we use right now to produce these little toroids, we use an arc, a small and low level, but it's definitely an arc arrangement, and that's I would envision doing that same process.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the in terms of energy density, you've got this tube that you're talking about, this 3 meters or 1 meter in length, 3 feet. How much energy are we talking about? In comparison, for example, you've got your internal combustion engine that drives your car down the road. The thing's a heavy piece of equipment that sits in, under the hood of your car. How big would this thing be in comparison?
We've actually done some calculations on that, and I my best calculations at this time show that it would be comparable to an electric generator of about that size. In other words, if you you run a car at about 100,000 watts if it's an electric car. And that generator is similar to an internal combustion engine. I mean, you need so much energy to push your car. And they all end up being about the same. But where the advantage comes in is in fuel. One advantage is in fuel, we'd have a very small fuel packet. And so that makes the car lighter and things, but basically the mechanism to, in our case, to produce energy, that is to produce heat, which in turn would be converted most likely into electricity, you need a generator to do that, and by the time you have the heat and the heat removal and the conversion, you in the, using a Carnot cycle or something similar, you're going to end up with a generator that's similar to what you have under the hood right now.
So the primary product of this reaction is heat, and then you're converting that heat into torque through some kind of a engine system.
That's
I imagine
the first way to do it. That's correct. That's the easiest to do right now, to convert from where you are, you know, or to go from a fossil fuel system into this kind of system.
In our coverage that you apparently follow along on our daily news, we very often will cover new engine technologies where people are converting a large number of input fuels. It doesn't have to be regular or unleaded gasoline. It can be much more crude input into rotation through these engine systems very efficiently, very clean, and this would, as you get this developed, I would imagine that it would be a good opportunity to start out with a much better launching system, or I guess launching with a good engine system as compared to going with something that is status quo right now, which is way behind where the technology is.
Sterling, that's why I read your website. I mean, I'm watching all these other people do all this great stuff, and there's really no other place that I've found where I can go and get a summary, a recap of what all these marvelous people are coming up with. Sterling Engines, I have found to be really of use potentially for this kind of thing. A Sterling Engines looking for a great heat source. And as you point out, there's a lot of different ways people can get into that. But there's also can produce the heat. But there's a lot of other good things that you guys talk about and put on your website. So I'm going to work and produce a good heat source, and we're going to find the right way to convert that into a torque. Now, one of the things down the road that is exciting, if you think about it, is that if we can really get to the boron-proton answer, which produces helium only. Now, helium is doubly ionized helium ion, and what that means is it comes off at a high rate of velocity. And if we're really clever and really can invent the right things, you can actually take the energy off using, dPdt, using an electrical without the Carnot cycle. And that would give us about an 80 to 90% efficiency. It's so far beyond good news. We didn't even talk about it because it's way down the road. We have some steps before we start getting that excited. But in the interim, we're going to use a lot of these other things that you're helping to get people to understand and see and help to get an audience for. So hopefully a lot of these technologies will be coming along.
How would your technology compare to focus fusion, for example?
I've looked at focus fusion, and I understand some of what they do. I don't pretend to be an expert enough to know, but I would say this. They're looking for about the same kind of money that we are, and I wish them luck. I mean, I hope they can do it, or I hope we can do it. But mine can be done in a very small package, and I think theirs is going to take a little bit more, but we'll see.
Yours... You were saying that compared to the existing energy-generating systems, such as an engine in a car, yours is going to be a comparable size, whereas theirs maybe need to be a little bigger to accomplish the same amount of power output?
That's my guess. I have talked with them, and I've read their things, but I haven't spent the time to go through it thoroughly, so I can't really compare the two. I know they're looking to produce a toroid, plasma toroid, sort of like we are, and use that as the basis for the fusion. And I have looked at how they plan on doing it, looked at some of the patents and things that they're basing it on. But I can't speak to how well they can do it because they're sort of like we are. They haven't quite done it yet, but they seem to have a reasonable technical plan to get there like we do. So we'll see how that works out.
Uh-huh. Yours, Focus Fusion was featured a couple weeks ago at Google Tech Talk, I think they call that. And Eric Lerner gave a really good presentation. Be good if that'd be quite an honor if they had you on there one of these days too.
Well, you know, I have only one thing. I want to get this working, and I realize if I can do a few more steps, I can get it to the point where I can demonstrate it to where people will say, "Oh yeah," you know. I'm not quite at that demonstration level. I can demonstrate it with the physics. I have a lot of really high-level scientists who co-patented it and written papers, and, you know, they think the physics is there. I think it's there. It's why I work on it. but you got to make it work, darn it. And that's the rule of the. So I don't need to get on to shows. I don't need to write too much or do too much. I need to work to my lab. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a second about the lab and just curious from a day-to-day operations point of view. What goes on at Electron Power Systems? How long have you been at it? How many people are doing it? Is it a full-time venture? Do you have a bunch of people or just one of you working part-time? What, kind of give us an idea of what's going on behind the scenes there.
Sure. It's full-time for one person and part-time for a second. So it's like one and a half. And we're making a small 3-meter tube. So, I mean, this is not a tokamak that needs 120 people to run it or something. I mean, we run 8 to 10 experiments a day. We produce small plasma toroids that are stable. We do that on a daily basis. And what we are doing is building, making different electrodes and different pieces to the apparatus to try to make this a little bit bigger, enough that we can capture it. And while we do it that way in the lab, we also work on our model, our engineering model, to bring that in line with the data that we take in the lab. And we've gotten to the point where we've gone from an experiment a month to as many as 10 a day. All of that by just improving our instrumentation and improving our power supplies and improving what we've done. And so now we have it, actually have it in about an 18-inch kind of apparatus, and it's getting pretty exciting for us. But remains to be seen just how long it's going to take. And if we had 20 people working on it, it would slow us down. If we had five, that might be better off than where we are, which is why we've laid out our plan as to what we need to for optimal progress. But I have to tell you, we're making progress with or without. It's just a little bit slower. We've had a little more funding. It's like everybody else, a little more funding, a little more resources. We go a little faster.
Mm-hmm. What kind of funding are you looking for?
Well, we've done a business plan, and we talk to people periodically is probably the right thing. And we say we need about $2 million, really, to get to complete the milestones that would give a demonstration of a repeatable system where people could come in and look and see and say, oh, yeah, he's really doing this. And then from there you move out and get a little more capital so you can build a prototype that would be a pre-production prototype kind of thing where you could take it to a show and show somebody and say, this is how you get the power out, how it comes in, how much comes out, and what you can do with it. And that's probably another $8 million or so. So it's about $10 million to get to a true production prototype, but about $2 million to get to a true finished laboratory demo.
You were mentioning earlier some patents. You have several patents. And what areas of the technology are your strongholds in the patent protection?
Well, the first thing we did was learn how to make stable plasma toroids. These are little toroids, you know, like Cheerios, or about the size of Cheerios, that are formed in an arc and are stable in atmosphere with no external magnetic field. That, just to say that, is so far removed from what other plasma scientists are doing. They all work at very low pressure. We work at near atmosphere pressure. So when you make a statement like that, you just know you're going to come under a lot of scrutiny from a lot of different people, and we did. So we took our work and our math model and everything that we had done to some consultants, and you know, there's in the Boston area, there's a lot of really terrific plasma scientists, and we've picked out a few that are some of the top in the world, and they have taken a look at it, spent a couple of years coming up with very good mathematics that describe the whole thing, and we've published some papers, and then we decided we could patent it. So we have patented a stable plasma toroid that remains stable in with no external magnetic fields. Now, you contrast that with, like, the tokamak work, and, you know, they're working hard at it, very smart people. But they need a huge magnetic field for containment. And we have been able to get rid of that and get around that. And we make these. They're very easy to make. It's a self-organized, stable plasma, so it sets itself up if you get the conditions just right. And so with that patent, what that does is right now that patent looks to be a very fundamental patent. It's the only patent that claims that broad a claim. And I've got some very strong patent attorneys from Boston who assure me that that's where we are. So that's our claim to fame. Now, once I have that and I can get applications from that, then we'll write the application patents. Those end up being marketing documents, and that's what you do, and then you can license that kind of thing out. But, you know, we're another year or so away from that point, that part.
At what point do you envision yourself going after the international patent area?
Well, that's money. That's an enormously expensive process. That's more than what I can do right now. And it's not like anybody is really trying to copy what we're doing. It doesn't work quite that way. So that would be part of the, probably part of that $8 million number that I put down. After you get the demonstration in your lab, it's worth going after the international patent. We actually did some of that initially when I jumped a little ahead of myself, if you will. I got the first patent, and then they say, you really ought to go international, and we spent some money on it, but it was just beyond what we could do with the kind of funding we have. I mean, you're talking almost probably $100,000 to $150,000 for one international patent for the different countries that you really want to. And if you're not producing something and getting income from the product, that's you're really ahead of yourself. So we stepped back and said, well, let's hold off on that until we get a little further along.
Mm-hmm. Earlier we were talking about the heat product of your device, and we mentioned some engine applications for converting that into usable electricity or torque. Of course, another method would be thermoelectric technologies, where they go direct from heat into electricity. And I'm just curious which of those two systems are looking most promising to pair with your technology.
Well, I know Lou Brown, who's the president of Eneco, who's doing exactly that. And Lou, actually, is a friend of mine, and lived in the next town over here, Massachusetts. And for several years, he advised me and helped me and helped me to get my feet grounded in the theory, get the theory right. Because Lou's a PhD physicist, very smart guy, and a plasma scientist. And then he moved out to Salt Lake City to take over that Eneco company, which does exactly what you say. They produce electricity from heat. It's a very good technology. And they struggled for a bit in getting their prototypes from the theory into something that works, and then getting the funding. And my understanding is they're a great potential technology. They need a heat source, and they'll produce electricity. That's why Lou and I are good friends. We keep urging each other on, and he says, you know, I'm getting close. you got to come up with that heat. And I can't, and then I call him up and say, Lou, I'm getting close. So, yeah, I'd love that, because if you have no moving parts and it's a solid-state method to produce electricity from heat, I got to tell you, you know, the cost would come down in no time because it would be a solid-state process. And Lou is his background is in a lot of solid-state work, so he knows what he's doing. And it would be a great marriage. The other one that I like is the Stirling engine, because while that's a moving part, you know, a lot of moving parts, it's not as complex as the internal combustion engine. And so it's a simple kind of way to do it. And that, again, is an engine that needs a heat source, and so it would be very good. Now, the internal combustion engine actually takes in the fuel and explodes it or combusts it, and so that's why it's just a bit more complex. But, you know, those are good things. So like I say, your guys and your website, the only place that really keeps your eye on each and every one of these things. And so years ago, before you started your site, I used to have to, you know, someone would call and ask a question like you just did, and I'd have to go searching out all, I'd spend time in a library and go look up in books and try to figure it all out. And that was pre-internet days. And then internet, you'd have to go search it out. Now I go to your website. You got everything on there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's good to hear. It's a nice motivation to keep us going on what we're doing.
Yeah. Oh, I hope you can, because it's, I think it's terrific. It's the only place I know to go to do that. But anyway.
That's what we're trying to do. Let's talk for a second about the rollout of this technology. And when you've talked about the milestones a little bit, and we've thrown out a couple of dates. Let's just maybe talk to the business plan type of bit or aspect of it now in terms of what milestones you expect to accomplish by when, and when we might see the beginning, and what form is this first going to take when it hits the commercial stage?
Well, here's what we know. We know that plasma toroids are made by several people. There's probably 9 or 10 government labs that work in it. They call them Spiromax. And they, but they don't make the dense ones. They make them in a very high vacuum, large apparatus, and they try to accelerate them for different Star Wars kind of applications. And we've just happened to find a way to make small ones that are stable, and we can do it in a very small apparatus, about 18 inches or so. So what do I have to do to get someone's attention? Well, I have to be able to make them a little bit larger, make them on demand, and capture them so that they'll set up and I can look at them with our instrumentation. And that's, you know, I almost didn't come on the show today because I think I'm going to be doing it in the next few months, but and didn't have I spent all my time in my lab. So I would expect that means next year I'm going to be able to do that. And when I can do that, what does it mean? Well, first, if I can make them and just make them sit there and get pictures, and then also measure the density and measure the properties, then you write the papers and people are going to get pretty excited. And that is when we go the next step. So the next step is you can accelerate those, and they'll hit a target. We've done that, and we can see that, and that's been done by others. You accelerate them and hit a target. And what does that do? Well, that will produce a monochromatic X-ray, because everything's all at one energy, all at the same energy. So monochromatic X-rays, which is a totally different subject than what you asked me to talk about, but it's a step on the direction of the energy. That would be the first demonstration, and we hope to do that next year, so we'll see. But that's just a lower level energy of the same technology. Then what do? Well, we add the energy, get it up to the point where we can get the process to work and make the improved neutron tube. And the day we do that, that's right now our plan is the following year, the year after, so 2009. We're hoping to do a lab proof of concept energy demonstration in the year 2009. And I have the detailed plan to get it done, and that's what I work at.
Mm-hmm. And then once you have that done and you're starting to work on your pre-production prototypes, do you have any idea yet which energy niche you're going to try and fill first? Are you going to go for the automobile? Are you going to go for home power or utility power small electronic devices and a pacemaker?
No, we have that pretty well sorted out. We could make an approximately 10 kilowatt energy unit. In other words, it would be about the size of the little Sears electric generator that's a standalone that you can use if your power goes out, and you can power most of your house. Actually, 10 kilowatts probably more than what you need, but would power your house with something that's small, costs about $1,000 in low quantities, and you can move it into your house and basically replace your electric service. But if you can make that small one, then all of a sudden people can buy them for their homes and things of that sort while you work on building one that would be suitable for a car or business, which would be up in the 100 kilowatt range.
Uh-huh.
So you make the small one first, easy to make. You can sell some, and then you make a little bit larger one that would aim at a good-sized market, which is a lot of businesses, a lot of bigger buildings, and also another version of it would also be useful for cars and things.
With battery power in these plug-in electric vehicles, 10 kilowatts is more than adequate to not only power a home and meet almost all even peak load demand of a home, but you could also plug in your car through the night and then drive it to work the next day using this technology, using the electricity that's been generated from the home power unit.
I agree with you. There's a lot of work's been done to figure all that power out, and I would agree that that could be very useful.
Yeah. So I think the typical home uses, on average, we're not talking about peak, we're talking about the average. It includes nighttime when you're asleep and nothing's running except maybe a few electronics that are pulling just, 10 watts or something. But if you, on average, I think it's about 1 kilowatt, and so 10 kilowatts is, and I don't know where I got this, and it's been disputed a little bit, but the peak load is, or your average load is 5% of your peak load, and so, if 10 kilowatts is going to handle most of your peak, you probably would need to have some battery backup to handle, like you're running your washing machine and you're cooking dinner and watching TV and you got lights on in the evening. That's probably going to go beyond 10 kilowatts. But if you had a little battery system, then that could handle it just fine.
Well, you're exactly right. We have added one other factor in there, which is why we've sized it at about 10 kilowatts. And remember, I could make it 12 or 8, and it's not all that hard to do because the process is very incremental. But if I talk about 10, I agree with it that electricity is a lot less than that. However, you would use this energy. It would be inexpensive enough. You'd use it for heat also. Right now, electric heat is something people avoid if they can, and heat with gas or oil, or mainly gas or oil. And what we would say is, well, if you're producing your own energy, you're going to heat with that also, because you get, depending on your conversion, from how you convert from the heat to the electricity. Right now, it's a Carnot cycle, which is inefficient. You got 70% heat left over, roughly, and you would use that to heat your house. So all of a sudden, you wouldn't just replace your electricity. You would replace electricity plus your heating with this same energy pack. And it would be a nice little technology. Now, you're correct in what you say, and you're thinking about the exact right thing. What's the average amount of electricity? What are the peak times? What do I do during the night when I don't need as much? Can I charge the car? Sure you can. But now you're still going to want to run it at roughly 8, say, kilowatts to charge your car and also get some heat into the house at night while you're not using any electricity. And then during the day when you want to run some things, you would probably divert more of it into the house for running electricity. But this would give you that capability to make a lot of these decisions.
How well will this technology govern in terms of, like, in the vehicle, you can hit the accelerator and speed up, slow down, almost instantaneous to what your demand is. Is this something that you can ramp up, ramp down the power rapidly, or does it take a while to turn the volume up or down?
We make these you can make these about one every millisecond, so you can slow the process down to where you can make one every second, or one every minute, or one every millisecond. And it's not hard to ramp it up and down. It's all electronic. Everything is electronic. So as long as the process is started, we can make or stop and make and stop. We actually use contactors now, but if we use solid state, it'd be really, really quick. So I would say you would push on the accelerator and you would see energy coming up very quickly, depending on the process you use to convert the heat. We'd be able to create the extra heat right away, but then there's going to be a little bit of lag time probably, depending on which kind of engine you have. So I'd say it'd be comparable to cars today. You wouldn't see a lot of difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, just for a second, let's talk about the spacecraft. How, in a spacecraft, are you converting heat to thrust?
Well, before you do the spacecraft, you're going to want to use the boron-proton process and produce helium ion. Now, in that case, when I have a helium ion come off, a helium double ion come off, that's a charged particle that's going to be coming along at about, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th meters per second, very fast. And it's going to be shooting through a coil, which will then see that change and will take the energy up, produce voltage, and slow that ion down. And you'll get that voltage out of there. And what that voltage will do is you'll be able to convert that into the power that you need. So by doing it that way, what you can do is avoid the huge heat buildup, because you can engineer this in theory to the 90 to 95% efficiency energy conversion, and you won't have enormous amounts of heat left over like you do with the chemical processes that we use today, or even the fission process. You have that problem. You have a lot of heat left over. So that's our hope, and that's what I've written some concept papers. That's a concept that we would put forward. If you're really going to have a long-distance space flight, you got to get to that point. But it's all stuff that people have worked out. It's not that we're making something up here. We're just saying this is a process that would be adaptable to what people have said. And if you go back to George Miley's book, he actually is the one that put that idea in my head, and that was the basis for a couple of concept papers.
Mm-hmm. On the other end of the spectrum, what would be the smallest practical amount of power that you could produce in the first 5 years?
Well, there is a lower limit. And when I talk about the neutron tube, which is about a 1 meter tube, about 3 foot in length, it's that's about what you need for this process. So we're a heat generator, an energy generator, in something that's about, 3 foot long. So you're going to get energy out of there, but if you want it to run your watch or your laptop or your iPod and things like that, you're going to want batteries to do that right now. Now, there, well, without getting too far afield, what this stable plasma toroid is a plasma toroid that has a large magnetic field internally. And for a number of years, we thought that that was going to be a great battery, but and it could be, and you can make these very small, but that's going to take a lot of research that we're not doing right now. We have a couple of other fish to fry, and our advisors have come back and said, you know, hey, you really want to make something that can run a car or power a house. You know, that's where... that's what's needed right now. Don't spend your time in a battery. So, you know, you still need batteries. You're going to need chemical batteries for years. We don't see us getting down in that area anytime soon.
Now, you know, in our news we cover Kirill Chikhanov's work. He's dealing with ball lightning,
right,
and what he calls quantum free energy. I'm curious... there seem to be some comparisons. You even use the word ball lightning on your website.
Mm-hmm.
How much overlap would you say there is between his work and yours?
Well, I'm always careful when I talk about ball lightning because no one can prove they have a solution to it, and it leads to a lot of great thinking by original thinkers that think, oh, this might be what it is, and they go off and, oh, this might be what it is. So, you know, I can't quite say, although I've read about his stuff, I haven't really looked into it too much. As that you can tell, I'm pretty busy. But anyway, we think that this stable plasma toroid is very much in line with ball lightning. And what I've done is really just learned how to make lightning in my laboratory and control it very carefully. And under some circumstances, I found I pop out these plasma toroids that are stable in atmosphere. And they look just like, well, lightning and what people have said. And it operates like it. So, you know, I'm very comfortable in saying this could be a solution for it. But I can't prove that until I either capture a ball lightning or until I make these big enough that they look like ball lightning and someone else says, oh, yeah, look, at they're all the same. So in that sense, if he's looking at ball lightning and I am, and that has been an inspiration for us. What his conclusions are, I relative to what ours are, I can't really say all that well.
Yeah. Maybe you could compare notes one of these days. We haven't given your website address outlet yet. Let's do that.
Okay. Electronpowersystem.com.
Yep. We've got some coverage on our website at Tez Wiki as well. In fact, I think if you Google it, we're probably right there next to your website. And then also, if people are interested in investing in your company, how do they go about doing that?
Well, I had somebody just contact me yesterday. Had been on my website. It has my email address. They email me. I send them a executive summary of the business plan, and then we go from there. And if they have interest, you know, we caution them that we're still researchy and. But as soon as we get over that, the potential is tremendous for a green energy source and a high-risk, high-reward kind of thing.
Okay, well, we've got a couple minutes. Is there anything, any other area that we've not touched on yet that you want to hit before we conclude?
Well, you know, we've covered just about all the subjects I can think of. The only thing I keep coming back to is I'm very thankful that you guys came along and you looked at our stuff and you gave us a fair look because you don't have any axe to grind. And I've put in proposals to people, and there it's a different process, and it's a difficult process. Your process has been an open-minded process. You've looked at it, as you do with all these things, and you're aware of all of them, and I appreciate that. I'm sure of the 100 research groups that you picked out, they would all say the same thing, because it lets people just go on my website, and then next thing you know, they're over on yours, and they see, I think it was Mary, was it, that wrote 18 pages worth of an analysis, and it's been helpful. So I can't say enough about how helpful that's been.
Great, I appreciate that. Well, we've come to the end of our segment. Clint, I appreciate you coming on our show with us today, and it was last minute, I should mention. Of course, it doesn't sound like that's any impediment to you. You could talk about this at a drop of a hat at any time.
It's what I do.
Yeah. But thanks again for coming on, and we certainly wish you luck in your endeavors, and onward and upward.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You bet.
Been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.